I'm going to start by making clear that I'm not claiming any special authority to speak about literature or C.S. Lewis. So my training is in theology, such as my training is, and I'll be speaking about Lewis and literature tonight as an interested amateur, but that interest for me runs deep. It's only in recent years that I've come to realise just how much I owe to the Chronicles of Narnia, which I read and reread as a child. I might just get a show of hands. Hands up if you've read any one of the Chronicles of Narnia. Great. Hands up if you've read them all. Oh, wow. Okay, there's some proper Narnians here. It's great. These stories, they shaped my imagination and my worldview in a lasting way. And my talk tonight is partly an attempt to repay the debt I owe to Lewis and partly an attempt to understand the power of these simple stories. I was just reflecting recently, I used to guzzle down the stories of Roald Dahl as well, but I don't think they really left any impact on me, any lasting impact, apart from a liking for horrible creatures and disgusting things in general. Hopefully you have a handout, just with some quotations. I'll be referring to that, but we won't be reading through every single section of the handout. So I'm going to start by saying something about stories in general, with the help of Aristotle. This is an event sponsored by the Thomistic Institute, and Thomas Aquinas would certainly approve of my starting with Aristotle. And then I'll say a little bit about the fit in general between Christianity and storytelling, and then a little bit about the crisis in storytelling experienced by post-Christian high culture, post-Christian, the artistic world that regards itself as post-Christian. And it's with that background then that we'll head into Narnia. So, we won't start at the very beginning, although it's apparently a very good place to start. Instead, we'll start in 4th century BC Athens and Aristotle's little work on the art of poetry, or the poetics. I've given you three quotations, 1, 2, and 3, on the handout from that work. And in that work, the philosopher Aristotle, he's categorising, he loves to categorise, and there he's categorising different kinds of works. What makes epic poetry different from history? What makes tragedy different from comedy? If history is written in metre, does it count then as poetry? And so on. He says, no, it doesn't. I've given a few quotations, as I said, in the handout, and you'll see that he regards drama and epic poetry as requiring a beginning, a middle, and an end. This seems obvious enough, but Aristotle is never afraid of stating the obvious. Literary narratives, he thinks, should, quote, neither begin nor end in a haphazard way. And whatever counts as middle in that narrative is related to the beginning and to the end in a meaningful way, so that the whole is unified, a complete organism, as he says, whose very completeness produces a special kind of pleasure. He gives the example of Homer's Odyssey. Homer, the poet, he says, doesn't say everything that happened to Odysseus. He selects those incidents that will form a unified whole in relation to the beginning and the end of the narrative. So when I use the word story in this talk, I mean story in this Aristotelian sense. The events recounted in a story, they might be real or invented, they might provoke fear, pity, surprise, but together the key is that they form a meaningful whole. It's not just a jumble of before and after events. Now, C.S. Lewis himself wrote an essay on stories, in which he notes that Aristotle is one of the few important thinkers to really reflect on what story means. He says, it is astonishing how little attention critics have paid to story considered in itself. Partly, he suggests, because story in itself is seen as childish. Story in itself as opposed to story as a form of social commentary or story as an opportunity to portray psychologically interesting characters. And part of the problem, too, is that stories, as stories, appeal to the masses. This might not seem like a problem to you. It certainly wasn't a problem to C.S. Lewis. But to some exalted spirits, literati with a destiny as high and lonely as that of Uncle Andrew will always find that broad appeal of stories as stories distasteful. What Lewis emphasises in this essay on stories is that he values stories primarily insofar as the boundaries of these stories, beginning and end, form the borders of another world, another atmosphere, he uses that word atmosphere, into which the reader is invited. The world of the story might be very like our world, or a little unlike our world, or very unlike our world, But is reading a story then simply a matter of escapism, if a story represents another world into which we can journey? Not necessarily, he says. The world of the story, although it might be very different from our own, might, even in its strangeness, reveal some truth about our world, the world we inhabit, and our life in it. So he gives the example of the wind and the willows. He loves to talk about Toad and Rat and all these characters in the Wind and the Willows. And he says that the whole story, paradoxically enough, strengthens our relish for real life. The story strengthens our relish for real life. This excursion into the preposterous, he says, sends us back with a renewed pleasure to the actual. We venture into the preposterous and then we return with a renewed pleasure to the actual. Now, reading this in Lewis made me think a bit about the relationship between story and world, especially in the Christian worldview. So Lewis talks about the story as a world, and that made me consider the obvious fact that for Christians, the world we inhabit, is a story. In many pre-Christian worldviews and post-Christian worldviews, the distant past and the distant future are regions of darkness and uncertainty. Was the world always here? Would it always be here? Who knows? And the Christian faith claims to illuminate those dark regions and to show an absolute beginning and an absolute end in the God who is love and wisdom. Just think of the Bible. It does start at the very beginning. It's an obvious point to make, but the Bible starts not just in the middle of the history of Israel, but right at the very beginning. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the story of the Bible goes right up to the end. The book of Revelation tells us, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away." It's hard for us to grasp the difference this perspective, this beginning to end perspective, made to the ordinary life of new converts to Christianity. But there's one vignette from Anglo-Saxon England that helps us to grasp it. Bede, the venerable Bede, the 8th century monk and historian, he writes about the conversion of King Edwin of Northumbria in the 7th century, about a century before Bede is writing. Edwin had received a letter from the Pope at the time, Pope Boniface IV, I think, which outlined to Edwin the Christian understanding of creation, the beginning of all things, and then the end of all things, the promise of eternal life. And the Pope places Edwin's own life story in the context of that big story. "This is where you're coming from," he's saying to him, "and this is where you can go if you choose life and choose Christ." The king himself is convinced to believe by a vision that he has, but then he gathers a council of his chief men, Bede tells us. And there, one of the chief men says the following. It's text number 4 on your handout, a really interesting text. So this is a 7th century Anglo-Saxon pagan speaking here, according to Bede. "The present life of man, O king, seems to me, in comparison of that time which is unknown to us, like the swift flight of a sparrow through the room wherein you sit at supper in winter with your commanders and ministers, and a good fire in the midst, whilst the storms of rain and snow prevail abroad. The sparrow, I say, flying in at one door and immediately out another, whilst he is within, is safe from the wintry storm." So life as this space between one, the entrance into a hall and the exit from the hall. In the hall, it is nice and warm and well lit. "But after a short space of fair weather, he immediately vanishes out of your sight into the dark winter from which he had emerged. So this life of man appears for a short space, but of what went before or what is to follow, we are utterly ignorant. If, therefore, this new doctrine," Christianity as a new doctrine, "contains something more certain, it seems justly to deserve to be followed." So for Christians, the world is a story, and the author of that story reveals to us the beginning and end of the story, or at least enough of the beginning and the end for us to know that we are indeed in the middle. The elements of the world are not just there. They're not just brute facts, brute dumb facts, as Bertrand Russell said. The events of the world are not just one damn thing after another, before and after, before and after. Rather, the events of the world, in this perspective, are seen as coming from somewhere and going to summer, coming from the good God and to the good God, the God who is beginning and end. Everything in the world, in this perspective, has this from and to aspect that makes it part of a story. I have to quote St. Thomas Aquinas at least once in every talk, or I don't get fed back in the priory. So I've given you a few little texts from the Summa Theologiae. We're not going to read through them, but they show his understanding of the way in which all things relate to God as their beginning and end. And also just a few texts on providence, how he understands providence. Providence, which isn't the same as determinism. So God governs the world, but he's not determining our every action. It's a providence that includes the possibility of our free choice, our free response. This perspective on providence means that events of the world are neither entirely necessary nor entirely contingent. And it seems to me, by the way, that an atheist, really, if he's a serious atheist, has to choose between one of those two options, the events of the world as being necessary or purely contingent, the Bertrand Russell option and the Jean-Paul Sartre option. So according to this Christian perspective, we find ourselves in a world which has existed long before us, with necessary laws that limit us in certain ways, but we find ourselves with freedom too, which gives us something that other things don't have, that mushrooms and cats don't have, the dignity of being co-authors of our story. In humans, then, according to this worldview, there's a dance between law and freedom, necessity and contingency. By living our lives, we tell our stories, brief stories, which form part of this big story and find their meaning in light of that big story. Our lives are not just a matter of before and after. They're not entirely determined and necessary, and they're not entirely contingent. We are from a beginning and going to an end. We're in the middle and we're free. I gave you some quotations from Aquinas, and he expressed himself with his usual rigor, imageless rigor, but, and it hurts me to say this, but St. Bonaventure, Franciscan, expresses the same ideas far more beautifully and in a far more interesting way by speaking about the world as a book. The world is a book with a divine author. That's a typical medieval image, Liber Mundi. Or also as a harmonious song. Really, really beautiful text there that's going to be relevant to Narnia, as we'll see. So I've given you text number 8, 9, and 10. 10 is really interesting. As animals follow each other in succession, they adorn the universe like a most beautiful song in which one syllable follows another. Does that remind you of anything? We'll get to it. There's a lot more that could be said here about the relationship between story and Christianity. A lot more that could be said about the stories of Israel, the people of Israel as storytellers. There's more to be said about the fact that the storyteller himself, the divine storyteller, appears in his own story. Very postmodern, that. God the Son becomes man, and he continues then within the story to tell us simple little stories, parables, and to live out a story which functions then as the key episode in the big story, an episode which Christians recall and represent and imitate in liturgy and life, or are meant to. All that aside, the essential point I want to make is that the Christian view of the world as story makes for a very fruitful fit between Christian faith and storytelling. Obviously enough, storytelling is a part of every human culture, but there seems to me to be a way in which it's particularly, if not uniquely, central to Christian culture. As an example, just think of the importance of saints' lives in Christian culture. Saints aren't just treated as powerful intercessors. Their lives, their stories are co-authored. The stories they co-authored are told and retold. Why? Because they're particularly distinct echoes of the love and wisdom we discern in that big Christian story. In medieval preaching, these stories come alive. They weren't simply read. They were preached from the pulpit and on the crossroads, along with also a massive variety of exemplary stories. This is something I'm studying recently, and I find it really, really fascinating. Thanks in large part to orders of friars like ourselves, Dominicans, Franciscans, Augustinians, you have these massive collections of really vivid and entertaining short little stories that were used to spice up sermons from Iceland to Catalonia to Roscommon. So this is an example, and I'm not joking about Roscommon, I found an example in a manuscript Well, actually, this one is from Limerick, a manuscript here in the Trinity College Library, an example that comes from this collection by Stephen of Bourbon, a French Dominican. So there's 1,336 stories in this collection, and it's circulated so that preachers will have lots of material with which to spice up their preaching. They're meant to entertain, they're meant to give pleasure, but also to edify, to lead their hearers somehow to reconsider the direction of the lives they are co-authoring. And if you crack open Chaucer's Canterbury Tales or Boccaccio's Decameron, you'll get a sense of how these stories travelled and just how central narrative is to medieval Christian culture. Think about the fact as well that there's a rebirth of theatre too in the medieval West. So in medieval cities, including this one, Dublin, various guilds sponsored plays in which biblical stories or saints' lives or morally edifying narratives are made present, colourfully present, to citizens. And sometimes these plays or cycles of plays were ambitious enough not just to tell a little few episodes, but to tell the big story, the whole big story, from creation to Last Judgment, like the York plays or the Chester plays. And it's possible that Shakespeare, as a boy, would have seen some of these plays performed before they were suppressed. Medieval Christian culture even begins to incorporate some of the pre-Christian stories, which the early generations, the fathers of the church, had regarded in some cases as a threatening influence and off-limits. So you have Ovid's Metamorphoses, a massive collection of Greco-Roman mythological narratives. They end up actually being read and reread and retold by Christians. Think of the Ovid Moralisé in French. Or think of medieval Irish literature produced by Christians, but which often incorporates or seems to incorporate older, even perhaps pre-Christian narratives. Think of the children of Lir, how after hundreds of years of enchantment, they hear the bell and then they are saved by baptism. C.S. Lewis gives another example of this Christian reuse of pre-Christian material in the English Renaissance poet Sir Philip Sidney, whose poem Arcadia is written in imitation of the great pagan poets. But the Greco-Roman atmosphere of this poem, Lewis says, is shot through with Christian elements. Text number 11 there is C.S. Lewis's commentary on that. Theoretically, he says, we are all pagans in Arcadia. When we're reading this poem, we pretend for a moment that we're all pagans. Nevertheless, Christian theology is always breaking in. So you have little phrases in the poem that show that clearly the author and the readers, they know the big story of Christianity and they believe it. But they're incorporating these pre-Christian stories into their big story. This might seem to us like anachronism, to mix these different registers and these different narratives, but it's not careless anachronism. So medieval Christian literati, they're not trying to recreate the narrative world of Virgil as Virgil understood it. They know the truth of Christianity. They know the big story of Christianity, the beginning and end of all things. And they're going to retell these old stories more or less explicitly as stories within that big story. That's how they're going to take the goodness and truth that they can find there and retell these stories within that big story. It's actually on this point, I think, that Lewis is more authentically medieval than his buddy Tolkien, Tollers. I think Tolkien is actually far more modern in this sense. He wants to create, he's kind of romantic in this sense, that he wants to create a space where there's no intrusion of Christianity. He believes Christianity is true, but he doesn't want Father Christmas to appear in The Lord of the Rings as Father Christmas appears in Narnia. He was furious at that, absolutely furious. But I'm getting ahead of myself here. The aspect of Christian culture that I want to underline here is this. Stories, all stories, real or invented, comic or serious, whether told on the stage or on the page, from a pulpit or from a bar stool, all stories, including the stories of our lives of which we are the co-authors, they find their meaning in the context of the big story, the beginning and end of all things. And they're to be judged as beautiful or ugly, as disordered or coherent, as satisfying or disappointing, against the standard of that big story of creation, providence, sin, redemption, and return. That's what I mean when I say the Christian art of storytelling. It's not that I think all good storytelling is necessarily Christian, but there's a specific way that Christianity wants to tell stories. And maybe in other religious traditions, you can tell me if you know it's the case, maybe in other religious traditions, there's something similar happening. I'm waxing lyrical here, but I'm doing so to highlight the aspects of Christian culture which are going to become really problematic in the post-Christian cultural sphere. When we think of atheism, I think we often treat it as an unhistorical phenomenon, an idea, or the denial of an idea. But I think it's important to recognize that atheism today is different from ancient Greek atheism, because rejecting God today means, in the West at least, also rejecting the big story of Christianity. And this renders problematic an enormous range of features of our culture, the culture we inherited. An atheist in the West today is necessarily a post-Christian atheist. Nietzsche understood this. I've given you the text there, the famous text of the madman. The madman who's actually speaking to other people who deny the existence of God, but they don't realize how significant what they're doing is. And so the madman comes in and he tells them just how significant it is. The death of God means wiping away the horizon. It means being unchained from the sun, losing a frame of reference, abandoning what had been a source of light and warmth. If the post-Christian atheist takes his task seriously, like Nietzsche's madman does, I think he's not only going to have to reject the idea of God as if that were something separable from the culture we've inherited, he's also going to have to cast aside a lot of what made European Christian civilization vital. He's going to have to shave off considerable chunks of the branch on which he's sitting. This has effects in political thought, in the world of music, and of course in literature. Wherever the serious, highbrow, post-Christian political thinker finds elements of political thought, which depend on the idea of a God-given human nature or a single end for humanity, she has some important work to do. Whenever she finds in music elements of resolution, which seem to signify a final resolution, or elements of harmony, which speak of a given order, she has work to do, and she's going to have to choose dissonance. And when she tells a story, she will find herself obliged to try to do so in a way that is different from all the storytellers who believed in the big Christian story. Killing God, as Nietzsche's madman realizes, involves an awful lot of collateral cultural damage. Many of the great literary works of the last century, they exhibit exactly the kind of anxiety we might expect then, an anxiety about telling stories in the Aristotelian fashion. Not because they have a problem with Aristotle, but because they have a problem with the way in which the Aristotelian story has functioned for so long as a vehicle for Christianity, as a sign of and subordinate to the big story of Christian faith. So for the post-Christian literatus, gone is the pleasure of an organic, ordered whole with a beginning, middle, and end, in which the parts bear some meaningful relation to each other and to the beginning and the end. That's now seen as old-fashioned, bourgeois, smug, boring, and cowardly. Serious writers of plays and novels in a post-Christian key will now have the task of illustrating the breakdown of the big story by actually overcoming story, or at least struggling with story, in their own works. I've given you a little text from an experimental novelist, an Englishman called B.S. Johnson. It's always good to have B.S. as your initials. Text number 13 on the handout. And this is really significant, the way he phrases this. Life does not tell stories. So life does not tell stories. The universe is not coherent. The world is not coherent. Life is chaotic, fluid, random. It leaves myriads of ends untied, untidily. Writers can extract a story from life only by strict, close selection. And this must mean falsification. Telling stories, really, is telling lies. So this guy says, telling stories, and he's really snooty in the way he expressed it, leave that to Coronation Street. Leave that to the masses, is what he says. Novelists have to leave story behind. And of course, James Joyce is going to be his hero here, but we'll get on to him. I'm sure you're all better read than I am, and you can think of a whole list of avant-garde works that seek in different ways to overcome storytelling. So the obvious place to begin is James Joyce's work, which has language itself as its focus rather than human action as such. So text number 14, the same B.S. Johnson, he says Joyce is the Einstein of the novel. His subject matter in Ulysses was available to anyone. It's just the events of one day in one place. There's a certain kind of unity there that Aristotle might approve of. But by means of form, style, and technique in language, he made it into something very much more. A novel, he says, not a story about anything. Notice the disjunction. What happens is nothing like as important as how it is written, as the medium of the words and form through which it is made to happen to the reader. And of course, as Joyce goes on, he goes further and further into writing novels as language games. Think of Finnegan's Wake. And it's really, really interesting. I came across this text, H.G. Wells writing about Finnegan's Wake. And he says, you've just entered into this game, okay? You're really, really smart. You're expressing things really, really powerfully in really interesting ways. But you've left behind the common man, he says. Precisely because he's leaving behind human action and just entering into the novel as a language game. Or think of the surrealism of Kafka. His point is not to allow us to enter into a strange world to help us to understand our own. In his writing, he creates an absurd, irrational world to say to us that we can't understand our world because it's absurd and irrational. It's unintelligible. And given that I've referred to James Joyce, a UCD man, I better name drop a Trinity man too. Samuel Beckett used to play cricket here, apparently. He was a really good cricketer. So he refuses, in his writing, he refuses to tell stories precisely because he thinks the world and life are absurd. Remember the critic who said of Waiting for Godot, it's a play in which nothing happens twice. So in one of his works, Dream of Fair to Middling Women is the title, the narrator remarks, the only unity, think of Aristotle, the only unity in this story is, please God, an involuntary unity. And a character in the same novel says, the reality of the individual is an incoherent reality and must be expressed incoherently. Think again of Johnson's point, life does not tell stories. And here we're being told by this character in Beckett's novel, your life is not a story. It's not something that makes sense. Your life is incoherent. And storytelling is therefore out. And literature, if it's going to be true to life, is obliged to be incoherent. Now, those among you who love postmodern literature might argue that there has been in that movement a recovery of story. But postmodern narrative is always, I think, it seems to me anyway, marked by the same post-Christian anxiety. Little stories, fragments of narratives, are fine, and they might supply local meaning. Islands, if you like, in a sea of absurdity. But grand narratives are absolutely out. The postmodern storyteller has to be constantly making fun of himself, constantly breaking up his stories, or piling up story upon story upon story with footnote upon footnote in order to obscure any meaningful narrative thread that threatens to be a grand narrative. I'm thinking here of a book like Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace. And just to show that I'm not kind of making this stuff up on my own, I've given you a quotation from Paul Ricoeur's Time and Narrative, where he says that we should consider the possibility that in this post-Christian context in which we find ourselves, we might be witnessing the death of the art of telling stories and the death of the novel as it was. So the writers I've mentioned so far, they're all brilliant. They're literary geniuses. And I'm passing over them far too glibly here. Apart from their brilliance, I should say what they all have in common is that I have tried and failed to read their books cover to cover. With Narnia, I'm more at my level, so we'll head there. But before we go to Narnia, I just want to point out that there is, I think, a bad way for Christians to respond to the deliberate, conscious meaninglessness of post-Christian literature. And that's to tell stories that try too hard to have meaning. Stories that kind of evacuate any drama, stories with flat stock characters and easy solutions and no ambiguity. Stories that are just a cipher for the big Christian story. Stories with no kind of consistency in themselves, and that are transparent rather than translucent. I went to the effort of searching on Google Images for all the writers I mentioned, so I may as well show them to you. There you go. But I think these sort of stories, Christian stories, that are transparent rather than translucent, that lack the kind of consistency that we expect from a good story, I think it's what we get today in a lot of movies that self-identify as Christian movies. I won't name any names, but some of you may have sat through them, and they can be painful to watch, painful especially for believers. And naturally enough, I think Lewis offers a better way forward. So I've already mentioned that Lewis was consciously and unfashionably interested in thinking about story for its own sake. And he was out of step with literary fashions in other respects too. So one of his biographers, A.N. Wilson, he takes Lewis to task for not paying attention to literary trends, for not staying up to date with literature. So he says, sure, C.S. Lewis is very, very well read, but Wilson's disappointed that he chooses apparently infantile stories over these important, serious works of literature. So Wilson writes about Lewis and his brother at the cinema in Great Malvern watching Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and points out sniffily, Lewis actually says that this scene was his favourite scene, the washing up of the dwarfs. And Wilson points out sniffily that this was the decade of Bertolt Brecht's greatest work, and Lewis is here watching Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And how, Wilson says, in the decade of Sartre's La Nausée and Joyce's Ulysses, could Lewis be whooping with delight at the reprint of Adventures of Tom Pippin? More than that, think of the Inklings, these committed Christian men drinking beer and reading their stories to each other. This is where Narnia was read and The Lord of the Rings was read and so on. And this is happening at the very same time that Samuel Beckett is sipping coffee on the left bank, staring into the void and resolutely not telling stories. Some would regard this contrast as highlighting just how old-fashioned and tweedy and backward and infantile C.S. Lewis is, above all in his choice to write fairy stories, children's stories. Maybe there's some truth in that, but it's worth remembering that Lewis, more than most, had witnessed real absurdity as a soldier in the First World War, and that he had been, before his conversion, just as resolutely atheist and materialist and post-Christian as any respectable 20th century intellectual. It's not that he was protected in a cocoon of any kind. One of the things that changed this atheist worldview that he had was precisely a discussion about stories, a late night discussion on Addison's Walk in Magdalen College in Oxford with J.R.R. Tolkien and Hugo Dyson. Lewis, at this stage, he was already a believer in God, but not in Christ. As a child, he loved to read Norse legends. These are the stories, he says, that awoke in him a desire for what he calls pure northernness, huge, clear spaces hanging above the Atlantic in the endless twilight of the northern summer. But the issue is that he finds lots of parallels between these myths and the big story of Christianity, and that becomes an obstacle to him, a sticking point. And it's Tolkien who gently suggests to him, really late at night, I think it was 3 a.m. or something like that, as they're walking around Magdalen College, it's Tolkien who suggests to him that maybe you should consider that Christianity is the true myth which underpins all the other myths and which can incorporate and account for all that is good and true and beautiful in those stories that Lewis loved. So that's how he converts to Christ. And it's no surprise that Jack Lewis, the Christian, is going to tell stories then. And even if he does so in a slightly tweedy, old-fashioned way, he's certainly not thoughtless as he does so. And he's certainly not ignoring modernity. Now, why did Lewis write these stories? It's notoriously difficult to pin down exactly how and why the Narnia stories were written. And it seems that in some ways, the impression that Lewis gives doesn't really match up to the way they were written. Lewis wants to really underline that these stories, they're not just a cover for Christian apologetics. He says the images came first. The images came first. First, when Lewis was a child, he has this image of a faun in a snowy forest carrying his shopping. And then later, he he starts telling a story about four children in the style of E. Nesbitt. And it was only as he was writing about these four children that Aslan, he says, comes bounding into the story. So it's not, he claims, that he started off to tell a story about Jesus and just named Jesus Aslan. I was asking my nephews and nieces in preparation for this talk who their favourite character was in the Narnia books. And my oldest nephew, he says, oh, Aslan. And I said, why? And he goes, he's Jesus. It's obvious. Actually, my brother told me as well that he was watching The Voyage of the Dawn Treader with his children. And there was a scene where one of them has become a dragon, a really, really scary dragon. And so my brother said to the little kids that were watching, are you not scared of the dragon? And one of them turns to my brother and he says, their dad, and he says, Daddy, that's not a dragon, that's Eustace. So the images, he says, came first. And then he fills it out. Aslan comes bounding into the story. Although it should be noted that recent work by Michael Ward has shown that there is, in fact, a definite planned unity across the seven books. I haven't given you the book on the handout, the title. It's called Planet Narnia. He proves convincingly that the imagery of medieval astrology actually accounts for these seven books, that each book corresponds to one of the planets with its astrological mood. What I'd like to underline is another overarching structure in the series, the fact that the world of Narnia has a beginning and an end. It's not often noted that in the series we witness the creation of Narnia and its consummation. The creation scene, of course, comes about halfway through The Magician's Nephew. By then in the story of The Magician's Nephew, we've learned that there are many worlds, that there is a wood between the worlds that gives access to these various worlds, and we've learned that worlds have beginnings and endings. So with Diggory and Polly, we've seen Charn, that world, with its old red sun. Charn, we're told, at the end of all ages, all its ages at least. And we know by this stage in the story that worlds can go wrong. There's that fantastic scene with all these kings and queens, former kings and queens of Charn lined up, and Polly and Diggory move along the row, and they see that they start off looking kind and handsome and wise, and then cruel but still happy, and then cruel but no longer happy, then despairing, and finally the last in the row is Jadis, the queen, the last queen of Charn, who is all fierceness and pride. Later in the story, these characters and several others from London, they find themselves in an empty world. Queen Jadis, channeling now Samuel Beckett, declares, "This is an empty world. This is nothing." But then these characters hear a song sung by a lion, a song that actually begins to produce light and growth and life. Echoes of Bonaventure there. The grass bubbles up and produces dogs and elephants and squirrels. From among these beasts that this song has produced, the lion then calls some of them out to form a circle around him. And he looks at them, he breathes on them, think of Genesis, and then in the deepest, wildest voice anyone had ever heard, he says to them, "Narnia, Narnia, Narnia, awake. Love, think, speak. Be walking trees, be talking beasts, be divine waters." And he goes on then in a strong, happy voice to say, "Creatures, I give you yourselves." And then with the gift comes a warning. "Treat the dumb beasts gently," he says, "and cherish them. But do not go back to their ways, lest you cease to be talking beasts. For out of them you were taken, and into them you can return. Do not so." So reading all this at the age of 8 or 9 had a huge impact on me. I remember vividly the impact it had on me. The atmosphere of a dying world, the world of Charn with its red sun. The atmosphere of a world being born. The notion of being called up out of matter, out of dumb matter, into life and speech and freedom. Now, I wouldn't have explained it in those terms at the time, but I was captivated by all of this. Less captivating at the time, I have to admit, was the final book in the series, The Last Battle. I'm not sure what you think of The Last Battle, but it seems to me that it might be the least successful of the series as a book for children. But it plays a very important role in the series because it shows the end of Narnia, the end of that world, the end of that story. In between these books, of course, there are several excursions of children from our world into Narnia, and all, or nearly all, of these children are involved here at the end too, in the last battle. Each generation of Narnians comes and goes, but because, as we're constantly reminded by the author, time passes differently in Narnia, the children from our world, in their comings and goings, they have a bird's eye view of the big story of Narnia. So we get in this series the big story from the perspective of these children. So as I mentioned, I never really loved this book, but I understood in the company of Peter and Edmund and Lucy and Eustace and Polly and the whole gang, I understood with them that Narnia has a beginning and an end. An ending that is happy beyond belief for those who follow Aslan further up and further in, with the discreet suggestion that some of the inhabitants of Narnia might actually have excluded themselves from Aslan's country by their free choices. The dwarves are for the dwarves. I remember again, when reading this, I remember rethinking the world around me. It's not that I hadn't heard the Christian story of the world's beginning and end. It's that this journey into a strange world, the world of Narnia, it gave me a fresh sense of our world as being from God and to God. It's not just that the story of Narnia either made me reconsider our world story. It actually helped me consider the importance of personal stories. It sounds like I was a really serious 8-year-old. I was also doing all the kind of things that 8-year-olds do, like eating muck and so on. But the little philosopher in me was thinking. So think of Edmund. He betrays his brothers and sisters for a bit of Turkish delight, something entirely understandable to me at the time. But when he repents, he has a conversation with Aslan. Powerful scene. It's just Aslan and himself walking together in the dewy grass. And Lewis tells us, there is no need to tell you, and no one ever heard, what Aslan was saying. But it was a conversation which Edmund never forgot. I remember being furious when I read that at the time. I wanted to know, the nosy little 8-year-old that I was, wanted to know exactly what Aslan had said to Edmund. But the author was denying me that knowledge. And in fact, this is a point that he repeats on several occasions in the Narnia books. So in my favourite book of the series, The Horse and His Boy, Shasta, as nosy as I was, he wants to know the full story of what happens between Aravis and Aslan. Was it you who wounded Aravis, he asks. And Aslan replies, I am telling you your own story, not hers. I tell no one any story but his own. And again, Aravis wants to know what will happen to one of her slaves, and Aslan replies to her, I am telling you your story, not hers. When I read this, I remember coming to realize the basic truth that every person is living out their own story, and that these other stories are largely unknown to me. I remember coming to realize that other people are a lot more mysterious to me than I had thought before. But as well, I remember realizing that I, as small as I was, had the power to be an author, or at least a co-author, of my own story. That I am a talking beast called out of dumb matter into freedom, into speech, and called to goodness. Again, I wouldn't at all have articulated it like that, but I remember, again, really vividly, I remember the sense of walking taller after reading this, and really desiring to be good, not just wanting to please other people, but desiring to be good, to tell a good story, to co-author a good story. I'm not a lonely object in an empty world, I realized. I wouldn't have said it like that, but this is what I came to realize. I'm a storyteller within a story, told by a storyteller who knows me and who loves me, and who has given me myself. My life, I realized, isn't merely a matter of before and after, but from and to. I'm in the middle of a story between beginning and end. And that is how the Narnia stories lastingly impacted me. When I read later in life Lewis's writing on story and what he thinks stories can achieve, I was really stunned by how thoroughly the Narnia books achieved this purpose, their purpose, in my case. The story, Lewis said, remember, should strengthen our relish for real life and send us back with renewed pleasure to the actual. And this is exactly the effect that Narnia had on me. And I'd be very interested to hear if these books had the same effect on any of you. Given too what I've outlined about the modern rejection of the big story of Christian faith and culture and the resulting crisis in storytelling itself, I think it's actually quite impressive how calmly and cheerfully, without anxiety, without trying too hard, without trying to please his colleagues, Lewis simply tells good stories, delightful stories, in which the big story, the big Christian story of our world, creation, providence, sin, redemption, and return, is represented and rendered strange and interesting and attractive. Should Lewis have been reading Ulysses instead of Tom Pippin? Should he have been reading Sartre instead of watching Snow White? Maybe. But he did excellently what a Christian humanist must do. He studied the big story of our faith in such depth and with such devotion and in so many of its aspects that when he started telling the story of Narnia, Aslan was always going to bound in, just as the bells rang for the children of Lear and Providence smiled on Arcadia. Thank you. Yes?
Your respectable Susan
in the last book. Oh, yeah, Susan in the last book, because this is becoming topical now because of Philip Pullman. Philip Pullman really doesn't like the fact that Susan doesn't seem to go to Aslan's country, but she hasn't died. It's not the end of the story for Susan. And it seems, some people would say it's kind of misogynistic because she's into things like lipstick. That's the explanation. I don't think it's necessarily misogynistic. I think the issue is that she's, because in other cases, Susan's kind of virtue is really emphasized and not in a stereotypically feminine way. I think the issue is growing up, wanting to be an adult. I think that's the major problem, that she wants to be an adult and to impress other adults. She's lost something of the freshness and the innocence of youth. And that seems to me to be the issue. There's an article about this. Oh, where is it? Lewis, the Reapcheeps help. I posted this on Facebook. I can't remember where it is, but it's a response to Pullman's critique of Susan not ending up in Aslan's country. But I think that's it. Now, other people will come in and say, well, that very point that Susan isn't there because she grew up, that shows just how infantile C.S. Lewis was and how emotionally stunted he was. This is A.N. Wilson's account of C.S. Lewis. And he compares him to Warney, his brother, who clearly was emotionally stunted in many ways. And he relates all of this back to Lewis's childhood trauma, losing his mother and being sent away to boarding school 2 weeks later. But I think of how he starts off the Narnia books, the dedication of all the Narnia books. He dedicates it to his goddaughter, I think. And he says, books, stories grow more slowly than little girls do. And now you're too old for these stories. But one day you'll be old enough to start reading fairy stories again. And then you'll take down this book and so on. And so I think there's that idea that there's a freshness and an innocence that's not exclusive to children, but children are the kind of, it's their special property. And I think that's why Susan doesn't end up there. And I think it's important for the drama of the thing, it's important that she doesn't end up there. But we might just call things to a halt there, and I'd like to thank you all for coming, and thanks for your attention.